Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, Prosecuting Dictators, the Indictment of Nicolas Maduro. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Manuel A. Gomez, a Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Global Engagement at Florida International University. We also have the Honorable Roger F. Noriega, a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. We also have the moderator, Harut Jack Samra, an associate at DLA Piper. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Harut, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting us in this, I think, timely and very interesting program. As you mentioned, Greg, at the very beginning of the COVID crisis, which seems, I think, in many ways, a long, long time ago, but really wasn't very long ago at all, the U.S. government and the Department of Justice announced the indictments of former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, as well as 14 current and former Venezuelan officials. The charges against these individuals included violations of sanctions, narco-terrorism, corruption, drug trafficking, and a variety of other violations. This is not without precedent. I mean, we look back to, in 1988, the prosecution of former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. But it is, of course, a very, very rare, very, very rare thing to have a government, including the U.S. government, prosecuting the dictator of a foreign regime. This program, I think, as a result, will touch on all of the unique legal and political challenges involved in just this kind of endeavor, prosecuting a foreign dictator. As Greg mentioned, we have two really terrific panelists. The first is Professor Manuel Gomez, who's an associate professor of law and associate dean of international and graduate studies at Florida International University in Miami. He specializes in international law and dispute resolution with a focus on Latin America, and has taught and lectured extensively throughout the Americas, Asia, and Europe, as well as published in those places. He has significant litigation experience throughout the region, including as an expert. He's a graduate of the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello in Venezuela, as well as having completed advanced legal studies and an SJD at Stanford University School of Law. Also, we have the Honorable Roger F. Noriega. Ambassador Noriega served as visiting fellow, currently is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and formerly served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Prior to his service in the U.S. Department of State, he also served as ambassador to the Organization of American States, as well as on the staffs of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House International Relations Committee. So with that, as we jump into the topic, I think it'd be helpful just to set the table a little bit and talk about the current situation in Venezuela. What has been transpiring over the last several months, and how does the current U.S. policy in response to that play out? So if Manuel, if you can just introduce us a little to the current situation, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Harut, and it's an honor to be here. I'm delighted to share some thoughts about this topic, which of course is not a happy topic, but it's a topic that in all seriousness requires the attention not only of Venezuela and the United States, but the rest of the region and also the world. It has implications that go beyond national borders. So the situation now in Venezuela, at the epicenter of this is an institutional tug of war that involves an interim president, Juan Guaido, who became an interim president of Venezuela in January of 2019, pursuant to a constitutional provision that says that when there is no valid president, then the head of the National Assembly, which is the equivalent to the U.S. Congress, will be the president. And it's an interim position. It's an emergency provision of the Venezuelan Constitution that had not been used before. that vested Guaido with those powers. The idea was that that was going to lead to a quick resolution. It didn't happen that way. You know, we are halfway through 2020, and that transition is still on the way. It's not only the head of the executive or the head of the state that is at stake, but it's also the judiciary. There is a Supreme Court that had been appointed by Maduro that is still exercising or carrying out its functions, and there is also a Supreme Court that is functioning in exile, and there's a number of other positions that are, you know, that are dual positions in a way. That's the kind of the general landscape. There have been a number of developments, you know, right after Guaido became the interim president of Venezuela. There was a widespread international support, more than 60 countries, depending on how you count, because some countries were very clear in saying, we will support this transition. Others were not so clear in mentioning that they were supporting a Guaido administration, but they wanted a solution. The United States was the first country to give support or declare support for this solution. It had given then legitimacy to the Guaido solution. Let's call it the Guaido solution. Guaido was able to appoint a special attorney general, someone based here in the United States, and that gave some effectiveness to his functions. You know, they were able to preserve some assets and prevent further looting of Venezuelan-owned assets by the Maduro regime. There are some downsides, and we can talk about those later. I think this is a probably good overview. Let me know if you want to add anything else.
Sure. And the Guaido began to serve as the interim president in January of it was 2019. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. Sorry. Manuel, please, Professor Gomez, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I cut you off.
And since then, as you suggested, the U.S. has been very, very involved, including as the first government which recognized President Guaido as the democratically elected president of Venezuela. The U.S. policy has been very, I think, U.S. policy has been an important part of this sort of global process that you've outlined. And if I could ask maybe Ambassador Noriega to talk about the U.S.'s role and the policy that it sought to implement through this process.
In the last 6 years, U.S. Efforts against the Maduro regime were intensified. It began with legislation passing the Congress under sponsorship of Bob Menendez, co-sponsored with Marco Rubio, that specifically denied visas and authorized sanctions, financial sanctions, against persons involved in gross violations of human rights. That began with maybe several dozen officials, particularly notorious people, identified by U.S. authorities and sanctioned. But at the end of the Obama administration, they were more interested in keeping some momentum behind their normalization, unilateral concessions to the Castro regime. And so there was a conscious decision where they dispatched a senior U.S. official, Tom Shannon, to Caracas, asking Maduro to cool it in his confrontations with Obama, and there would be no additional sanctions applied. So we really started at that point to pull our punches under the Obama administration. In the meantime, you had the DEA in particular digging in on investigations of suspicious transactions and some outright drug trafficking by individuals within the Chavez and the Maduro regime. And it really began rather intensely under Chavez in the year 2010. 12, really, where they were conspiring with the FARC to send cocaine to the United States. And then some vast money laundering exercises, basically beginning to bust out Venezuela as a country the way the mobsters would bust out a pizza parlor, except this is an oil-rich economy that took in $1.5 trillion in this period since Chavez took power in 98. And so they started, there was vast money laundering that was detected by different authorities in the United States, U.S. attorneys in Southern District of New York, Eastern District of New York, certainly Houston, Southern District of Florida, U.S. agencies, HSI, DEA, as I mentioned, and others. And so you saw the law enforcement efforts going on. Then, in earnest, this sanctions against individual leaders of the regime began when President Trump took office. The Tariq al-Assami, the former governor of Aragua State, former minister of interior, I think he's minister of industry now, was designated as a drug kingpin by Secretary Mnuchin in February of 2017. And then since then, very intense efforts by the Treasury Department in interagency process designating particular individuals under violation for IEPA, using IEPA authorities, Kingpin Designation Act as well, Global Magnitsky Act, and again, the Menendez legislation to sanction individuals. So it's been targeted individuals for the most of the last 4 years. But in the last 7 months, the Trump administration, in support of the of its effort to promote Guaido as the legitimate successor and the rightful president, began to adopt sectoral sanctions that made it harder and harder to do business with PDVSA, made it harder and harder to make any sort of investment or engage in any transaction with that government. And then you folks have seen very specifically, in kind of dramatic fashion, these tankers trying to deliver oil to the United States, and the Treasury Department literally designated particular ships because they're calling on the Venezuelan ports and carrying Venezuelan oil. So this targeted sanctions thing has become so broad, it's against, you know, probably 100 Venezuelan government officials, and then against particular commercial entities within Venezuela.
Right. And thank you for that, Ambassador Noriega. I think you mentioned earlier, and before we jump into the indictment, which I'll ask Professor Gomez to give us an overview of, you mentioned the Chavez and Maduro regime's relationship with FARC. If just for the benefit of our audience, if you can tell us a little bit about FARC, what it is and what its relationship with the Venezuelan regime has been over the last, 8 years, as you mentioned, since 2012.
So all of this criminal conspiracy that I talked about in Venezuela has involved a partnership, really, with narco-trafficking organizations. Before he was captured, Chapo Guzman spent a good deal of time in Venezuela, hosted by a Venezuelan cartel formed by initially Chavez and that involves the military, called the Cartel de Soles, named after the symbol on the epaulets of generals in the Venezuelan government and the Venezuelan military. So there is this ongoing criminal conspiracy that involved the FARC, which is the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, that recently signed a peace agreement, but has all along, and certainly in the last 15, 20 years, been engaged in cocaine smuggling. And so you actually had the Venezuelan authorities using oil revenue from PDVSA to pay for cocaine. And this has all been borne out by a series of indictments in great detail, where Chavez began this criminal conspiracy. So, in addition to those cocaine smugglers. This whole criminal corruption, money laundering, all of that has been abetted by the Russians and the Chinese. So this is a massive crime scene, really.
And so that, I think, sets the table a little bit for the discussion of the actual indictments, at least as to the drug trafficking indictments against Maduro and a number of the other officials. They relate directly to some of the specific issues in the relationship with FARC that you've outlined. But there are issues that go beyond as well, drug trafficking, including violations of some of the sanctions measures that have been imposed that you mentioned, and outright corruption, including by high government officials who have considerable property here in South Florida. Professor Gomez, if I can ask you to just go into a little bit more detail and tell us a little bit about the indictments that were issued in March by the Department of Justice and some of the individuals who were involved in those.
Okay. So on March 26th, as you pointed out at the beginning of the call, there was a press release that basically announced the unsealing of a 4-count superseding indictment led in the Southern District of New York against Nicolas Maduro and other members of the so-called Cartel of the Sun, or Cartel de los Soles in Spanish, including Diosdado Cabello, Hugo Carvajal, Cleaver Alcala. And there were also other co-defendants mentioned, which are FARC people. Arango and Santrich were also mentioned in this indictment. What's important, you know, overall about the indictment is that based on investigations, it connects Venezuelan officials with FARC leaders that are involved in drug trafficking activities. And that's what brings this expands the interest of the indictment beyond Venezuela. You know, it really puts it into the regional perspective that this is not just something that happens involving Venezuelan public officials in Venezuela using Venezuela resources, but obviously, you know, there is an impact on the United States because the drugs are being imported into the United States, but the drugs are being also transported with, in conjunction with the FARC. So the charges are narco-terrorism conspiracy, which is kind of interesting because narco-terrorism is not a technical offense by itself, but it's a broad category that involves drug trafficking and terrorist activities, and that has unfortunately become endemic in the region. Now Venezuela being on top of the list. There were also charges involving cocaine importation conspiracy, possession of machine guns and destructive devices, conspiracy to possess machine guns and destructive devices. The indictment explains in detail that this is something that goes back to the 90s, as Ambassador Noriega was mentioning. It's interesting also that this indictment connects the enterprise, the criminal enterprise, with another case that garnered a lot of media attention a few years ago involving two Venezuelan nationals, Campos Flores and Flores de Freitas. In Venezuela, they're known as the narco sobrinos, or the narco nephews, because they are related to Maduro. So what's interesting is that this indictment, you know, which also made the news, it displays a great deal of coordination among different agencies in the United States. It also comes in line with a number of other cases that Ambassador Noriega was mentioning. There are cases in the D.C. District against Padrino López, who's the Minister of Defense. There are cases in the Southern District of Florida against the Chief Justice of the Venezuela Supreme Court. There are cases against El Aissami in the Southern District of New York. There are cases, at least two cases, against other Venezuelans in the Eastern District of New York. There are cases in the Southern District of Texas. There's the Villalobos Cardenas case, the former vice minister of energy. And there's even a case in the District of Arizona against Colmenares Villalobos, who's a former Venezuelan Air Force officer. The allegations in all of these cases, you know, have the common thread of corruption. The common thread is also the trafficking of narcotics. But there are also charges related to other illicit activities. So it's a pretty dense group of cases. And the indictment that was revealed on March 26th, it's really the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. Or that's how it appears from the outside.
Right. And if I could just ask a quick follow-up question. You've mentioned, and I think Ambassador Noriega mentioned as well, PDVSA. If you can tell the audience a little bit about PDVSA, its role in the Venezuelan sort of government and broadly in Venezuela, and how that ties in these cases.
Right. So PDVSA is the acronym of Petróleos de Venezuela, the oils of Venezuela. So it's basically it has been since the 1970s the main public corporation. Venezuela being an oil economy, which means that it derived most of its income from the exploration and exploitation of hydrocarbons, had nationalized the oil industry in 1975. Created a holding company that over time became a very efficient, one of the top 30 companies in the world, very well organized. It was really run as a private company, but the main shareholder was the government. Things changed when Chavez became stronger and stronger. He took control over PDVSA. PDVSA continued to be a very profitable company, now politicized, a big difference. And then, but then was used as an arm of the government. First of all, you know, it was a cash source for the Chavez government. But then, according to some of these cases, became also used as a vehicle for illicit activities, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. PDVSA is the crown jewel, or was the crown jewel, of Venezuela. So there's a great deal about PDVSA regarding the control of PDVSA, regarding the control over the subsidiaries that PDVSA owns, including a company formed in the United States called CITGO. There have also been a number of cases involving PDVSA unrelated to the criminal stuff, unrelated to the drug trafficking stuff. So PDVSA is really at the epicenter of everything that has to do with Venezuela. So it's that big of a deal. You have a country that had a single commodity economy, oil, and the unit or the agency in charge of it was a company that is PDVSA. So that's how important PDVSA is to Venezuela, and how tangled up it is with the rest of the Venezuela related cases.
Right. And you know, Ambassador Noriega, before we jump into the next topic, I don't know if you'd like to comment a little on the overview that Professor Gomez has given us of the indictments, and maybe referring back to the prior point that we talked about in U.S. policy towards Venezuela, how these indictments, you know, played in to the broader U.S. policy.
Right. Well, the professor's done a very good job, and I'm sure he could talk for another 2 hours explaining the way that PDVSA was at the core of a massive theft, really. When oil was selling for $150 a barrel, PDVSA was issuing bonds to generate revenue, and the bond trading was the object of a lot of corruption. People soaking these assets for their own benefit. Leaders of the regime, yes, and bagmen of the regime, these billionaires who are sort of cronies of Chavez and Maduro, serving as a conduit for channeling money away from PDVSA, away from the treasury, for structuring offshore accounts. Just to give you an idea of how massive this is, the Lava Jato, the infamous Brazilian Odebrecht corruption scandal, they chronicled $700 million and call this the biggest corruption scheme in the Americas. The fact is, one guy who's now sitting in federal prison, Alejandro Andrade, had $1 billion, and he was not a fast learner. He was not the sharpest tool in the shed. $1 billion. Another person who's free right now, not indicted, as a matter of fact, who actually serves as a source for the U.S. intelligence. He manages a fund worth $50 billion. That's 10 times the international reserves of the Dominican Republic. One guy. And you have others. There's a man who's sitting now in Cape Verde who was captured there. His name is Alex Saab, who is basically an architect of all of the money that the of much of the money that the cronies of the leadership of the regime have looted. They're managing this in global accounts and assets all over the world. He's awaiting indictment in the United States, and people are very concerned that maybe Cabo Verde will not turn him over to U.S. authorities, because we've lost two others who have been held in custody, wanted for extradition under the Obama administration, and they got away. So again, massive fraud, and all of the sanctions that I referred to, where they designated targets, we've basically frozen probably no more than 5% of the roughly $350 billion these people have looted.
Well, and so turning to, I guess, the intergovernmental dynamic here, I mean, you in your presentation, Ambassador Noriega, mentioned a number of the organizations of the U.S. government that are engaged here, whether it's the various U.S. attorney's offices that have been involved, the Southern District of New York, Southern District of Florida, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston, but some of the agencies, DEA, Department of State, and the Treasury. Having had the experience on the Department of State side and as well at the OAS, how do these kind of interagency dynamics play out on a matter as sensitive as this one internationally?
Well, this is really complicated because it's law enforcement, and generally U.S. officials do not want to get in the way of U.S. The Department of Justice and law enforcement organizations like Homeland Security or the DEA, and so it's a very sensitive, complicated situation, because obviously U.S. diplomats want to know if the U.S. attorney is going to indict leaders of another government that will have implications for us. But the U.S. law enforcement has been driving forward on this for most of the last 10 years. And I think the State Department, at least under the Obama administration, was not crazy about this. It's well documented that the Obama administration shut down investigations about Iranian involvement in narco-trafficking, Hezbollah involvement in narco-trafficking and in Latin America. But certainly in the last, since President Trump made Venezuela sort of a priority, the DEA and the Homeland Security and the various prosecutors you mentioned have had the bit in their teeth and have pushed forward in this omnibus unsealing indictments and additional indictments that were announced by AG Barr. So, and this has been in the service of a foreign policy meant to bring down, frankly, the Maduro dictatorship, an illegal regime that's involved in its directly in criminality. So lest folks in the federal society think that this is prosecuting dictators, just going after people for human rights violations or constitutional problems in their own country. No, this is prosecuting criminals, people who are involved in the violation of U.S. law, trafficking in cocaine, heroin, illicit gold, and engaged in money laundering activity, all in violation of U.S. law.
Right. And that's actually a good point, maybe worth clarifying. And I open this up either to Professor Gomez or to Ambassador Noriega, that the allegations in these complaints do very closely touch the U.S., whether it's the drug trafficking allegations, but more specifically, you know, extensive money laundering. One of the individuals, I believe, was indicted, at least here in the Southern District of Florida, actually resided here part of the year and spent a lot of money here. And that was part of the recitation in the indictment. But then, of course, also, you know, flow of funds related to PDVSA, as Professor Gomez mentioned, with CITGO, which is maybe one of the principal, you know, subsidiary entities of PDVSA, is a major sort of refinery here in the U.S. and other presence. I don't know if either of you wants to expand on sort of the connection here to the U.S. beyond just the policy of the government, but some of the actual violations of U.S. law that you referenced. Maybe Professor Gomez, if you want to kick that up, or whoever.
Just to add quickly, you know, what the ambassador said is true, and that's also a distinguishing factor between U.S. actions and the actions that have been taken by other countries, including Canada. Most recently, last week, the Swiss government announced that it was extending its sanctions to other Venezuelans. Switzerland had, following the European Union, decreed sanctions against Venezuelan public officials back in 2018. Most of those sanctions had to do with human rights violations, extrajudicial killings, other crimes that are not deemed anymore as domestic or national offenses, but you know, they're repugnant to the civilized world. The big distinction between those types of sanctions, obviously they don't have the teeth that criminal sanctions or the criminal trial looming over someone may have, but they're helpful in the sense that they reveal, number one, that this is not just one country against another; two, that it's not just one type of criminal act that is being carried out, but you know, a catalog, a panoply of criminal conduct that is repugnant to the world. So going back to the United States, because of the close connection between Venezuela and the United States, the likelihood of those offenses affecting the U.S. legal system was much, much higher. And what's really interesting is that even after many of those investigations were underway, you see that many of these public officials or former public officials were coming to the United States, were living in the United States. So it's really interesting from the standpoint of an outsider to see that despite the fact that there were active investigations against public officials, that people were still coming back and forth. Fortunately, it seems that the authorities have made a decisive move against those people.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Noriega, I think you wanted to chime in on this as well.
No, that's fine. I'll wait for your next question.
All right, sure. And so I think Professor Gomez's response just on the last point is a good transition point to talking about sort of the international policy consequences of this. And he mentioned in his introduction that somewhere around 60 countries have in one way or another recognized Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela, including the United States. A handful of countries have actually recognized President Nicolas Maduro as the president. Can you tell us about how this has played out globally, and particularly in the last few months since the indictments?
Right. Well, I would say that as we've tried to make the case, this is a criminal regime. This isn't a mere dictatorship, and it has vast resources at its disposal. And these are people who are not going to give up the privileges and immunities of being criminals and protected by the Venezuelan state and security services, are not going to give them up because they lose an election. They will never lose an election. They will not leave power voluntarily. And so most of the countries that recognize Juan Guaido as the president and support that gambit also say they are against the use of force. Most of them would probably criticize the extraterritorial application of U.S. law against individuals because they see themselves as potential victims of this sort of thing. So they're not really helping. They're not doing very much. They're basically preventing us from doing more and doing what is necessary to fix the problem. So, but I think that at the very least, we need to press forward on the criminal investigations. But I will say, I wanted to point out the very dangerous role that Russia and China play in all of this, along with the Iranians. They are deeply involved in helping the Maduro regime evade sanctions. Complicated triangulated transactions, some outright violations of U.S. law to move money, to tap into money that they have in accounts, billions of dollars that they have in accounts, involving oil sales. Oil is literally overflowing in Venezuela because they can't move it. So moving oil out of Venezuela to other countries, marketing it, blending it offshore so they can sell it somewhere else, is all underway to evade sanctions, to generate capital for the regime, and with the full support of the Russians, the Chinese, the Turks, and the Cubans being involved in this. So there's a bigger conspiracy going along. And the fact is, Maduro's allies are doing more to help him than President Trump's allies are doing to help him deal with this dictatorship so close to the U.S. shores that's not only looted the country, but tormenting 30 million people and inviting the kind of economic, social meltdown right here on our doorstep.
Mm-hmm. And you've alluded to this. I mean, in addition to sort of the international consequences of this, there are other stakeholders here in the U.S. as well who have been instrumental, I think, in affecting U.S. policy, whether that's the Venezuelan community, which has been growing and has become, I think, a very relevant force, particularly here in Florida, but also the oil and gas sector and a variety of others. How has that played out in shaping policy? I mean, and again, I understand that we want to separate, the U.S. government's foreign policy as it relates to Venezuela from the law enforcement a component to these indictments, but how have those various stakeholders tied into the U.S. policy?
Well, there are, it's a terribly complicated situation, frankly. There are some American companies that have asked for waivers, who've lobbied against sanctions against Venezuela over the last 6 or 8 years. More or less, they've gotten out of the way. They've found fewer and fewer members of Congress to do their bidding for them. But certain cases, for example, Chevron has had a toehold in the country. They've gotten a license to be able to continue their activities, which were sort of on the margins, and they were minority stockholders. I think that they're not going to get an extension. Again, this is just my gut feeling, because they've become much more important part of the oil exports that are production as well is going on. Because they've had this when this waiver, I think the Venezuelans or the people that manage the oil production there have put more and more in that Chevron basket. And so I would imagine that the Trump administration or the Treasury Department would be less likely to give them an extension of their waiver. On the foreign policy side, on the political side, the I think President Trump came to know the Venezuelan people because of his Doral Country Club, which is very close to a community here in South Florida, West Venezuela, they call it, in Western Florida, that has been the place where a lot of Venezuelan immigrants have come. And the president, in that hospitality industry before he was in the presidency, I know for a fact, interacted with these people. And I think he got a really good feel for what wonderful people they are and how bad the stories are from back home. So he's been strongly committed on this. I think the problem is he hasn't gotten the policy, the creative ideas that were needed to break the stranglehold. I think that the State Department's policy has underestimated Maduro and overestimated the ability of their allies, the Venezuelan opposition, to carry the fight to him. And part of that is that many elements of that opposition are compromised by the same kind of corrupt testaferros, cronies of the Venezuelan regime. And so they've kind of pulled their punches in certain respects. But I think if you read Bolton's book, and I'll shut up real quick, the president recognized this. I think he had misgivings about whether Guaido was tough enough to face down Maduro, and certainly I don't think we have the kinds of policies, and I think he feels this, the tactics in place that are going to be required to defeat a criminal regime with vast resources at its disposal, enough resources to corrupt the opposition, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and so actually that dovetails with the last sort of topic. And I should mention, we will be opening up for questions in about 8 minutes. So if anyone has questions, please start thinking through them now, and you'll have an opportunity at about 1:50 to ask those. But turning back to the last topic that we wanted to walk through today is really how effective has this been? How effective has the U.S. policy been? And how and what is the end game on these prosecutions? You've already, I think, gone into some of the related points on that, Ambassador Noriega. But if you want to expand on kind of the end game here and where you see this going.
Should I let Professor Gomez jump in?
Sure. Yeah. Professor Gomez, if you want to chime in on this point, maybe follow up on some of what Ambassador Noriega has said, and then we can have a conversation about it.
Thank you. Well, the future we cannot predict. What's the end game? It's hard to say. The steps have seemed to be the right step at some moments. In some other moments, there is frustration. As Ambassador Noriega pointed out correctly, it is the Maduro regime is a very powerful regime. That, and let me add something to this. This is something in the making for almost two decades. The capital, the amount of money, the political power that Chavez amassed when he was alive, and then the Maduro really reaped the benefits of it, are no small problem. Guaido came about to be he had the refreshing look of someone who had not been tainted, young, grew up under Chavez. So basically this is someone who knows, how it feels to have his future, taken away from him and from his generation, lots of energy. But quickly after all this, the honeymoon period, you keep getting all these statements of endorsement by different countries from around the world, the U.S. leading the charge, but then the European Union, a lot of Latin American countries, the Organization of American States. So there was momentum. The humanitarian aid that Guaido seemed to have focused on at the beginning of his let's not call it a mandate, but at the beginning of his functions. But quickly enough, the Maduro regime, fought back There was also, at least from the outside, it looks like there was some lack of transparency from the Guaido team regarding how the goals would be accomplished, regarding appointments to people who were key in his team. People were basically appointed on a volunteer basis, Venezuelans of goodwill who lived in other parts of the world. But it's really hard to have a government that works that way. And then in the last few months, we saw some lack of coordination within the team, within the Guaido team, that was leaked to the public, and that's not good. And let me just end with a comment that I think ties into your question of how effective or what's the end game. At times, Venezuelans have seemed to hope that the solution to the problem that Venezuela is facing, because of the magnitude of the crisis, because of the regional and international impact, is something that is going to be achieved by foreign powers. There is a lot of Venezuelans who often talk about the U.S. coming into Venezuela, liberating the country, and so on and so forth. If you look around the world and if you look at a little bit of history, you know, the countries are owners of their own destiny. The final solution, the end game solution, has to have Venezuelans in it, has to involve Venezuelan institutions or whatever is left of them, has to involve Venezuelans making decisions for themselves. This is something that every government that has supported Guaido has said. The conundrum or the difficult situation is that the big question is, how do you do it if you have your hands tied? How do you rebuild something that has been so badly wounded? How do you create a strong team or a strong administration when you're building it from nothing? So I think the help from other countries, including the United States, because of some of the reasons that Ambassador Noriega mentioned, but also because of the close historical relationship between Venezuela and the United States, I think it's very, very important, very helpful, very welcomed by Venezuelans. But it's probably not the only thing that it's needed to get to an acceptable outcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ambassador Noriega, did you have anything you want to say in follow-up to that?
Well, I will say that, you know, Venezuelans are, that I know, are among the first to sort of say, this is our fault, we made mistakes, we shouldn't have elected Chavez, and et cetera, et cetera. We made mistakes because we followed a poor opposition and all of this. But I will say, as a non-Venezuelan, that this is a country that's been mugged by the Cubans, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians, and by criminal organizations that are murderous and powerful and have all of the money they need to subdue that population. And I just pray that people don't say, well, this is Venezuela's problem. They elected Maduro. By the way, they didn't. But they did elect Chavez. I was there when that happened. But they proceeded to, these people, these dictators, have proceeded to dismantle the weak institutions where Venezuelans maybe could have wrestled back control of their country, but in a very ruthless way, systematically, and while most of the Western countries, including the United States, ignored this, they've made it almost impossible for Venezuelans to extricate themselves from this situation. We will either be involved in a solution there very directly, frontally, and having to be provoked to use force, or you're going to have another Cuba completely subject to the denial of basic fundamental freedoms. But just as importantly, in this case, with oil resources and with Chinese, Russian, and Iranian backing and sponsoring narco trafficking and terrorism, which is already having a significant impact on U.S. security, I would suggest that's unsustainable. and that we will have to respond.
Yeah, thank you, Ambassador. And so, Greg, if there are any questions, we can take them. Otherwise, we'll keep the conversation moving forward.
Well, let's go to audience questions.
Hello, I have two questions. One is, what is the relationship, if any, with what was at one time going on in Europe and other, Spain, I think, that were in enacting laws that could have ensnared U.S. officials under the law, I think it was Spain or wherever it was. And isn't this opening that door for other countries who think that the U.S. has violated human rights and specific individuals in the U.S.? And the second question is, where are the rest of the South American and Central American countries in all this? I mean, that's there are a lot of countries down there. That's my questions.
Yeah, thank you, sir. And so maybe Ambassador Noriega, if you'd like to take the second question first and how this has played out in Latin America.
Sure. I think the gentleman was referring to Baltasar Garzon, who indicted and sought to have arrested like 20 years ago, Augusto Pinochet of Chile. And Garzon has been sort of a judicial celebrity, international judicial celebrity. Basically, what he is an enemy of the United States and of the West, Western values. And he uses his legal expertise to advance an ideological cause. He is, for example, he's been an advisor to many of the Chavista types and FARC types, the Colombian guerrilla types. So that was a partisan agenda, and that's why I hasten to add and point out that what we're talking about isn't prosecuting people for human rights violations. We're talking about people who are using the U.S. financial system to violate U.S. laws. We're applying sanctions to deny them access to the U.S. judicial system. You can do what you want to do, perhaps, in your country. It may be bad, it may be good, but you can't do it with the U.S. greenback. You can't use our financial system to violate these rights. And you certainly can't import cocaine into the United States, heroin into the United States, and in other parts of the Western Hemisphere where it has a bearing on our security. And when you violate our law, you're subject to indictment and prosecution in our law. It's not an extraterritorial application of our democratic or human rights values, although that there are other ways of pursuing those causes. In this case, we're talking about applying U.S. criminal law, applying the rule of law against people who violate it in a systematic way.
Right. And as far as how this has played out in within South America, I mean, as a former ambassador of the OAS has been pretty forward on this as well, hasn't it?
Yes, they have. And these collection of countries have undertaken explicit commitments deny the ability of people to travel and to from within the Venezuelan regime, from within the Maduro regime, deny them ability to travel to their countries, to do business in their countries. And there's been sort of spotty application in the last year, but there's at least a political recognition by, generally of these American states of the Guaido government and explicitly of the fact that the Maduro regime is a dictatorship that has no legitimacy.
Right. Professor Gomez, if you could comment maybe on some of the international criminal legal issues that the questioner asked about, including about Judge Garzon in Spain.
Sure. Yeah. So that refers to something that in international criminal law is known as the principle of universal jurisdiction, which is a controversial principle, and the controversy lies on the fact that it's not so well defined in all over the world, but it's pretty much a legal principle that allows or requires, and that there's a difference there. Some states think there's a requirement. Some say respect
Professor Gomez, I think you're cutting out. Would you mind speaking a little bit more clearly?
Yeah. So can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Better.
Okay. So I was saying that I think it's the comment, and certainly the Garcon comment on the Pinochet affair has to do with this notion that a criminal judge or a prosecutor could file an action irrespective of the location where that crime was committed. In the Pinochet case, the idea was to go after Pinochet for crimes committed during his regime against Spanish nationals in Chile. Anyway, so it's very controversial. Interestingly, in the Venezuela case, so Venezuela is a party to this treaty called the Rome Statute, but Venezuela is a party to the Rome Statute. And the Rome Statute is basically the international law solution for situations like that, for crimes against humanity and so on and so forth. Interestingly, there have been several petitions filed before the International Criminal Court against Maduro, not only by Venezuelans, but also Congress people from Argentina, Bolivia, and Peru, and so on and so forth. So what's interesting here is that a principle that may seem, or an approach that may seem adverse to what people think, has been turned against Maduro. And of course, we cannot say that there is an effective remedy as of today, but it's really something that has worked against them. So because basically that exposes them for actions in other parts of the world. So there's no safe haven. So that's my comment on that one.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Gomez. So we have 2 minutes left. Greg, if there are any other questions?
There is one more. Caller from 414, you're on the line.
And I'd ask the caller just to keep it quick.
Thank you. My question is whether the magnitude of the threat posed to the United States by the crimes illuminated, reduced in the indictments against Maduro and his cronies, coupled with the absolute unlikelihood of extradition, justifies military action to apprehend him, a la Manuel Noriega, and whether that's feasible either militarily and or from a policy perspective for the United States.
And so let me, with the last word, we have about a minute left. Ambassador Noriega, would you address that question?
I think that when you see that Venezuela is a platform for criminality that has destroyed institutions in neighboring countries, certainly in Colombia, certainly in Central America, and the same criminality that is fueling the transnational organized crime and that's eating away at Mexican institutions right on our border, this criminal threat, yes, represents a threat to us that requires a much more robust and, I would say, law enforcement response. It's not going to be diplomats or OAS resolutions that get these criminals to give up power. However, I also think that there is a possibility that there will be some provocative action as the regime, if the regime comes under a much more internal pressure, where we would have not just the U.S., but other countries, probably Colombia, maybe Brazil, be willing to step up in a sort of a humanitarian response. But I do think that this is something where the U.S. should consider creative application of force. The president started that with the deployment of military in the Caribbean that has sought to sort of quarantine the country and cut off the ability of them to generate revenue through this narco-trafficking. And certainly we have two people at large who are within our grasp. Hugo Carvajal, principal, probably top 10 narco trafficker, is at liberty in Spain, a NATO country, which refuses to capture him. And Alex Saab, who is a architect of this criminal enterprise that is in Cape Verde. If either one of those ends up in U.S. custody, making declarations in a U.S. court, this will have a very dramatic impact on the regime in terms of infighting and stability potentially in the country that could, in a way, that could destabilize it in a positive way.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Ambassador Noriega, and thank you as well to Professor Gomez and to the Federalist Society for enabling us to have this wonderful conversation today. I think a provocative and interesting one. I turn it back to you, Greg.
Perfect. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.